You need protection. You can start by getting me out of here. Henning's speech was faster and more determined now. You know you can't even stand up. I can if I have to. Bjarne shook his head and said nothing. He knew how stubborn Henning could be. He took a deep breath. I'll go and make some phone calls, he said, but there's someone else here who wants to speak to you. Oh, right, Henning said. Who is it? Bjarne walked over to the door, opened it, and waved to someone, opened the door a little wider. When Henning saw her face in the doorway, drawn and pale, but beautiful, he immediately tried to push himself up in the bed, but didn't manage. He sank back down onto the mattress. Nora took a few hesitant steps into the room. She brushed the hair from her eyes, then came towards him. There was so much Henning wanted to say. That was perhaps why no words came out. He followed her with his eyes as she sat down on the chair where Bjarne had been sitting, keeping her distance at first, but then moving the chair closer. Neither of them said anything. They just looked at each other.
I'll be back shortly, Bjarne said, and closed the door behind him.
There was silence in the room. Tears streamed from Nora's eyes, and she rummaged in her bag for a handkerchief. I want to thump you, she said, and put her bag down on the floor. Her voice was tense, quiet, as if there was something holding back the words.
Thump away, Henning said. Just don't hit me here.
He pointed to his shoulder and attempted to smile, but his lips were split and dry, so he ran his tongue over them. But instead of carrying out her threat, Nora held a hand out to him. He took it, held it. Cold, sweaty, small. Once upon a time, they'd held hands everywhere, all the time. It had felt so strange to begin with. He didn't like public displays of affection and found weddings and kissing in front of other people awkward. But after a while, it became natural, as did the distance that gradually crept in later, the daily routines that never quite worked, not once Jonas had come into the world. Their hands never sought each other out, because they were always full of something else. Food, a rucksack, nappies, a pram, post. Everything became so trivial, and they didn't have time to see each other, to look after each other. And they drifted apart. Henning and Nora were separated when Jonas died. It was Nora's week to have him, but because she wasn't feeling well, she'd phoned Henning and asked if he could collect Jonas from school and have him for the night. She didn't want him to catch anything. A decision that was so full of love had changed their lives forever, and he knew that Nora would carry it with her for as long as she lived.
How do you feel? She asked.
Awful. How about you?
Me?
She let go of his hand and wiped her nose, gave a fleeting, albeit sad, smile.
How am I?
Well, actually, she said as though she hadn't thought about it for a while, I don't have the words to describe how I feel. Henning said nothing.
They'll keep you in here for a few days, no doubt, she said after a pause.
Henning was about to say, I can't, but gave a quick nod instead. He noticed her cheeks were slightly plumper than when they last met.
Ivo was a good man, Henning said.
It felt odd to say it out loud.
However strange it sounds, well, we actually became quite good friends.
Nora's head sunk down to her chest.
He talked a lot about you, she said.
Did he?
She nodded and dried a tear.
He really looked up to you, as a journalist. Nora stood up and turned away. She sniffed and quickly put a hand to her face. Henning tried to push himself up in the bed again, and this time managed. He half sat up, holding his weight on his left elbow. She turned back. Another Nora was standing in front of him now. She was angry, more determined. "I've tried to think if there was anything about Ivor's behavior in those last few days that might explain what happened. If he said anything in passing, but..." She shrugged and opened her hands. "I can't think of anything. Ivor's dead, and you're lying there half dead." She waved her hand at him. Henning didn't like what he saw in her eyes. "So," she said, coming towards him, "what can we do to stop all this?" Henning shook his head.
"You don't need to do anything."
"I knew you'd say that."
Her voice was hard and angry.
"Yes, with good reason," Henning replied. "There's no way you're getting involved in all this as well."
She stopped right by the bed.
"So you don't think I'm involved enough already?"
"You know what I mean." Henning looked at her. "You're pregnant, Nora," he said, trying to control the volume of his voice. "The risk is too high. These people don't think twice about killing, and I can guarantee that they're interested in you as you were Ivor's girlfriend and my ex, so the best thing you can do is to lie low and wait and see if I manage to..."
"Right. That's so bloody typical," she snapped. "No one can sort this out except you."
Henning took a deep breath.
"I don't want to argue with you, Nora. You and I can't work together on this. I would never forgive myself if anything happened to you. It was enough with..."
Henning looked away, but he could feel Nora's eyes on him all the same. A moment later, Bjarne came in through the door with a steaming cup in his hand.
"Hi," he said.
Neither Nora nor Henning answered. Bjarne registered the loaded atmosphere and kept quiet.
"It's too dangerous, Nora," Henning said eventually. "Do me a favor. Stay away. Keep out of the way until this is over."
Nora just stared at him for a long time. Then she picked up her bag from the floor and put it over her shoulder. She marched towards the door and said to Bjarne as she passed,
"I'll be waiting outside."
Bjarne and Henning said nothing until she'd banged the door closed behind her.
"Make sure she stays out of this," Henning said.
Bjarne gave a faint smile. Henning knew that Nora could be just as stubborn as he could when she wanted to be.
"Just look after her," he said, and realized he was tired. "Now, more than ever."
Bjarne nodded.
"We will."
Chapter 31. Their retreat had been long and time-consuming, and only now that they were back at Flurim Amitage's place did Durim Redzepi finally feel safe. But he was far from relaxed. He paced back and forth in the living room, still clutching a gun in his hand.
"Brother, can't you just sit down for a moment?"
Armitage asked. Redzepi shook his head.
"You're making me stressed as well,"
Armitage added.
"I can't help it."
Armitage was sitting in front of two big computer screens. Redzepi had never really understood what he did and how he did it, but his good friend from Metrovica was invaluable when it came to data, cameras and surveillance, and that would definitely come in handy over the next few days. His phone rang. Redzepi didn't recognize the number, but he guessed it might be Daddy Longlegs.
"Hello,"
he said with a kind of sigh.
"Yule is in Yulevau Hospital," Daddy Longlegs said. "You'll have to go there and..."
Redzepi closed his eyes and blocked out the rest of the sentence.
He shook his head.
I can't just walk in and...
I don't care how you do it, as long as you do it. And preferably before he talks to the police.
Fool saw me, he protested. He knows what I look like. I'm no good to anybody if they arrest me, and we've got the funeral tomorrow, so I can't...
Red Zeppi was interrupted by an exasperated sigh at the other end.
We shouldn't be talking about this on the phone, Daddy Longlegs said. But you'll just have to find a solution, and fast. You were given a job, and it's not finished yet. Call me on this number from another phone when you've got something to tell me, and it better be good news.
He hung up. Red Zeppi swore again and threw the phone down onto Armitage's sofa.
I can tell that went well,
Armitage remarked. Red Zeppi didn't answer, carried on pacing back and forth. What the fuck was he going to do? He looked over Armitage's shoulder. There were live pictures on the screens from each of the cameras they'd set up in the graveyard. Each screen was divided into four squares, 8 cameras in total. He took a step closer.
Henning Jules got an ex-wife, hasn't he?
Yep.
Red Zeppi thought it all through again. Neither he nor Jeton Pockety should venture outdoors right now. He pointed to Armitage's screens.
Do you have any more of those?
Armitage understood that he was talking about cameras.
No, but I could get some. How many do you need?
2, 3. And I need someone who's good at getting into people's houses. If you can do that for me, I'll make you rich.
Armitage smiled.
Now you're talking my language, brother.
Trina wandered around the living room as she checked the newspapers on her mobile phone. None of them had anything new to report. Not even TV2 news channel, which she had on in the background, could tell her anything she didn't already know. The journalist who had been shot had not been named yet. But Trina was terrified that it was Henning. They said on the news that the journalist would live, but how serious were the injuries? Trina found the telephone number for Ullevål Hospital and dialed, asked to be put through to intensive care. After a long wait, she heard a woman breathing heavily into the phone and then spit out,
"Intensive care?"
"Hi," Trina said hesitantly.
"I'm calling to ask if my brother was admitted earlier on today."
"What's his name?"
"Henning Jule," Trina said.
There was a moment's silence.
"And you are?"
"Trina," she said, and
wondered briefly if she should give her surname, that she might get help then. But she didn't.
"My name's Trina," she repeated. "I'm his sister."
There was another long silence.
"He was admitted at 1604, the woman at the other end said finally.
So, her fears had been right. She closed her eyes and swallowed a sob.
"Can you tell me how he is?"
she asked when she'd pulled herself together.
"I'm sorry," the woman said. "The patient has to name you as family before I can give you any information, and I'm afraid he hasn't."
"No," Trina thought. "Of course he hasn't."
"I can go and ask if he'd like to talk to you."
"No,"
was Trina's prompt reply.
"No need. I just..."
She stopped herself.
"Sorry?"
The woman's voice was softer now.
"It's nothing. Maybe you could say..."
Trina changed her mind.
"Forget it. Thank you for your help."
Trina hung up and sat down on the sofa, wrapped herself in the blanket, thought long and hard. Then she got up and started to walk around the room again. Eventually, she had an idea. She wondered how much money she had in her account. It didn't really matter. If she was short, she could always ask Powell Frederick for help. She tapped on the speed dial for Katarina Hacklam,
her former head of communications at the Ministry of Justice and Public Security.
Trina?
Katerina's voice rose as she said the name, as though she was surprised to get the phone call, but was also a bit wary.
Hi, Trina said.
There was a pregnant pause.
How are you?
Katerina asked.
I'm fine, Trina said. But I have a problem, and I wondered if you might be able to help me.
Chapter 32. Henning was not prepared for how unsteady he would be when he got out of bed and took his first few steps. It felt like the morphine and blood loss had knocked everything off balance, and his arm was also stiff and couldn't be moved. He put one foot in front of the other. The doctor who had come by only half an hour ago said it was a matter of time. He would soon be able to go to the toilet, eat, shower, and dress on his own. The pain would also ease, the doctor assured him, even though that seemed unlikely to Henning at that moment. Henning sat down again and took some deep breaths. There was a knock on the door. Bjarne popped his head round.
There you are, he said. Are you ready?
Depends on how you look at it.
Bjarne smiled. Henning could see through the window that it was dark outside. He wondered if it was late afternoon, evening, or night.
We're the only ones that know about this, right?
Bjarne chuckled softly.
What do you think? That I've sacrificed my job to get you out of here without clearing it with my bosses first?
Henning looked at him.
There was no other way of doing it, Bjarne said. And relax. Hardly anyone knows where we're going. Anything else you want to know before we go?
Henning raised his good hand to his face to wipe away the sweat. Then he took a deep breath and said,
Right. I'm ready.
He stood up again, took a step, stopped. The walls were dancing in front of him.
Do you want me to hold your arm or support you in any way?
Henning scowled at him.
You look a little groggy, that's all, Bjarne said. It's okay to ask for help, you know. That's exactly what I'm doing. A bit more help, then, Bjarne said, and smiled.
Henning didn't answer. The policeman looked around.
Did you have a jacket with you?
I did, Henning said, but I think they had to cut it off and must have thrown it away.
Anything else we can wrap around you? A blanket or something? It's pretty cold out.
Henning shook his head.
I'm so warm that... Yes, yes, and it doesn't hurt anywhere, Bjarne teased. I'm sure it won't matter if you get a cold as well.
Henning ignored him and took another step. It was more controlled, even though he felt like he was on board a tiny boat on a vast ocean.
You okay?
Bjarne asked.
Should I get a wheelchair?
It'll be fine, Henning said. I need to take my keys.
I've got them,
Bjarne said. Henning nodded and breathed steadily, trying to stop the images that undulated and spun in front of him.
Medicine?
Henning hadn't noticed that Bjarne was holding a plastic bag, which he lifted and shook. You could hear the pills rattle in their bottles. It sounded like it was coming from inside Henning's head.
You're going to turn into one hell of an addict.
Henning responded. Bjarne walked to the door and opened it for him.
Come on then, Rocky. Let's get ready to rumble.
They left the hospital via a spiral staircase at the back of the building. The effort made him sweat, so it was good to get out into the cold evening air.
Where are we going?
Henning asked when they were sitting in Bjarne's car.
To a safe house we sometimes use when we need to look after someone. The owner is in Spain at this time of year. You'll be safe there.
Spain? Henning said. That sounds nice.
Bjarne drove carefully, making sure to avoid as many of the potholes in the road as he could. Henning tried to straighten up in the passenger seat. The movement made him grimace, so he tried to turn his mind to anything other than the pulsing pain in his shoulder. When they'd been driving for a few minutes, Bjarne's phone started to ring. He picked it up, checked the number, and then put it down again. Henning glanced over at him.
"Just work," Bjarne said. "Nothing that can't wait."
Henning must have fallen asleep, because when he opened his eyes again, they were there. The street was called Tennisveien. There was a big hall nearby, with cars parked outside. Henning tried to get out by himself, but couldn't do it. Bjarne hurried round to the other side of the car and helped him out.
"Oh, careful,"
Henning said. His arm hit the door as he got out, and a sharp pain shot through him. He stood swaying for a while as he gritted his teeth, took a few small steps, which made the world spin. The windows of the house were like mirrors, and he was glad he didn't see himself. He wanted to have a bath, but it would probably be a while before he could do that. Bjarne supported him up the small slope, and then let him go when he was steady again. Fumbled for the keys and unlocked the door. Bjarne went in, deactivated the alarm, and turned on the lights. Henning managed to get in by supporting himself on the door. He kicked off his shoes in the hallway and looked around. It was a fantastic house. Clean, white surfaces. He could see into a large kitchen that led into the living room, with a fireplace in the corner, TV, dining table, stairs up to the next floor.
"The bedroom is upstairs," Bjarne said.
Henning nodded and headed towards the stairs. He could manage as long as he held onto the banister. Upstairs, there was a TV den with a door into another room. The room was small, but big enough for Henning, and it had everything he needed. A window, a bed, a desk, and a small TV mounted on the wall.
"I'll just go down and make a couple of phone calls," Bjarne said. "Shout if you need anything."
"There is one thing," Henning said. Bjarne turned to look at him.
"What's that?"
"Do you know any Samis? Are there any Samis who work for the police?" Bjarne frowned.
"Samis, as in the Sami people, the Laplanders."
He looked at Henning with puzzled eyes.
"You're joking."
"No."
"You want to know if I know any Samis?"
"Yes, I do."
"Why do you ask?"
"Because I want to know." Bjarne looked at him perplexed.
"I know one," he said eventually. "A girl, or rather, a woman."
"Who is she?" Bjarne continued to study him.
"She's called Anne-Marie Serra," he said, "a forensic technician from the Crime Investigation Service who's been seconded to us for a while. We met her briefly at Ivar Gundersen's flat."
"Why do you ask?" Henning thought about it. He remembered Serra, of course.
"No particular reason," he said. Bjarne burst out laughing. "No, right," he said. "And there's a virgin with three children living just down the street."
Henning sighed. He would have gladly told Bjarne what he was thinking, as he'd helped him so much. But he couldn't say anything. Not yet.
"Thanks," was all he said. "For everything. You're a good man, Bjarne. Tell that to the taxman."
Bjarne smiled and went downstairs. Soon, all was quiet around Henning. He breathed deeply and relished the feeling of being alone, without having to fear that someone might burst in through the door at any moment. He sat down on the bed. His head was still spinning. He needed more painkillers, couldn't think with all that pulsing and thudding, so he got two tablets out from the bag that Bjarne had brought with him. There were a couple of bottles of water in the bag as well, and, not without difficulty, Henning managed to unscrew the lid from one. He swallowed the tablets, turned on the TV, and read about himself in the captions on the screen, even though he was, as yet, unnamed. Assistant Chief of Police Pierre Nerkelby said that there would be a press conference later on that evening. Henning relived the moment when he saw the mouth of Red Zeppi's gun, the sting in his chest. He was tired, so he lay down. His shoulder felt like it would explode, but he closed his eyes, saw the colours on the inside of his eyelids churning round and round and round. A peace fell over him, and then, once again, darkness. Chapter 33. That evening, Roger Bleistad did something he hadn't done for a long time. He went down to Brandbu and found a seat in the Sandbeck pub. A football game was being broadcast on a large TV screen, so he sat as far away from it as he could, but it was impossible to avoid the noise. The pub was fairly empty, and it didn't take long before he was half cut. At regular intervals, the barman came over and replaced the empty glass he had turning in his hands with a full one, as he thought about his mother and her funeral the next day. When his grandfather died in the late 80s, Bleistad had been in Amsterdam setting up a drugs delivery to Norway. His mother had phoned late in the evening to say that the cancer had finally got the better of the tough old man. Bleistad had sat in silence for a long time after, thinking about what a fine man his grandfather had been. Then he felt the need to walk, to find a bar that was still open, and to raise a glass to him. So he'd ended up sitting in Café Pollux and had a couple of beers. It was a fine farewell, even though he was hundreds of kilometres away. Which was why he'd wanted to have a couple of beers in honour of his mum, now. But once he'd sat down, he'd found it hard to stop at two. It did cross his mind how stupid it was to sit there in the open, when what he should really be doing was getting ready to leave, to drive far away from Brandbu as quickly as possible. But it was liberating, and it felt good not to give a damn. He liked the feeling of living on the edge, not quite being in control. But he would be stupid if he didn't do anything. He'd met Alfred in the supermarket. Ivar Gundersen was dead, and now his mum was gone too. How many more warning lights did he need? It was half time in the match, and an advert blared out over the loudspeakers. The glasses and bottles twinkled in the mirror behind the bar. A man was sitting on a stool in front of the taps, both hands round his glass. It looked like he was searching for the meaning of life in the froth. Bleistad heard the odd burst of laughter, but no conversation he could follow. A baby was crying on TV. And again, he thought about his mother. She had cried a lot. Every Christmas Eve, when that boys' choir sang on TV, her eyes welled up. But he always got the feeling it wasn't related to the music. He sat there drinking until everything was blurred. Perhaps that's why he didn't hear the voice at first, which belonged to a woman who was trying to get his attention. It was only when he saw something waving in front of his eyes that he raised his head a touch and looked straight into a face that he recognized, but couldn't place. "It is you," she said and smiled. Bleistad blinked a couple of times. "You do recognize me, don't you?" Her smile was teasing. "Of course," he said, rifling through his memory. "Helen," she said. "You came to my house a few months ago, changed the weatherboard cladding on the south wall?" Bleistad clicked his fingers. "That's it," he said, and tightened his grip on the glass. "Sorry, I..." "Ach," she said, poo-pooing it. "I'm used to no one paying attention to me." She pretended to cry,
which made him smile. And God, it was good to smile. Helen revealed her uneven teeth, but he liked the fact they were wonky and that it looked like she smoked. She was wearing an almond-coloured Stetson, a short jacket and tight trousers. He actually liked pretty much everything about her. "Are you here on your own?" she asked.
"Yes, I..." He looked down.
"I'm here with some girls," she said. "We haven't seen each other in 100 years, but all they're talking about is their kids." She rolled her eyes. "So just say if you'd like a little company." He glanced up at her, saw the look in her eyes. He remembered how chatty she'd been. He thought then that she was lonely, recalled the painful gratitude when he'd said yes to a cup of coffee after he'd finished the work. She lived alone, had presumably done so for a while. Bleistad hadn't noticed any men's shoes in the hall. The whole house had felt like a hangover from the '70s, something she'd inherited. Helen herself could hardly be more than 35, but there was something cheerful about her. Her face made him think of the sun.
"I don't think so," he said. "Not today."
It sounded like a rejection, and in a way it was. But still she stood there. "You look sad," she said gently, "like you could do with a bit of comforting." Again, the underlying invitation. Another time, Bleistad thought. Any other day, but right now he wanted to be alone. "Well, let me know if you change your mind. We're sitting just over there." She smiled. He raised his glass to her, and she swung her hips as she sashayed back across the room to her friends. Bleistad sent her a sheepish smile before buying another beer and settling down to meditate on his mother. It was a few months since he'd seen her, at the opera house at midday on the 4th of August. He'd found her down by the water. She'd given him a big hug and started to cry straight away, as she always did. Bleistad had chuckled in her ear and told her she mustn't do that. "I know," she said, "but I can't help it." They'd sat there for several hours. She'd taken a picnic with her for both of them, and then she'd shed a few more tears when he said he had to go. They'd agreed when and where to meet again. Frogner Park at midday on the 12th of December, so it would be easy to remember. They only had minimal contact via email. "I have to give her a proper send-off," Bleistad thought. He couldn't go to the funeral itself, but he had to be there, see her, the coffin, be near her one last time, lay some flowers on her grave. And he realized then how sick and tired he was of being on the run. Sick and tired of keeping a low profile, not engaging with people. Like Helen. Girls in cowboy hats. He didn't actually like Stetsons, not on men or women. But she'd worn it, with a teasing smile, as though she was perfectly aware that it didn't suit her, and that that was the whole point. She made him smile. He could count on one hand the number of people who had done that in the past 2 years. It would have been nice not to care about a thing, he thought. Just to live, be, not worry about the consequences. Maybe he should just say, "Here I am," and see what happened. He immediately stopped that thought experiment. It would not end well. He had to think of something. He couldn't live like this any longer. Chapter 34. Charlie Highseether was in the bath, alone, when the phone rang. He half expected it to be Isabel calling to say she was sorry that she'd been so difficult before she went to work. It was just that she wanted to do more than dance at Senzuela, now that everyone knew she was his girlfriend. "I'm tired of disrespecting myself," she'd said. "And surely it's not good for your business having a girlfriend who's an exotic dancer."
"Well, then maybe I shouldn't," he'd replied, and later regretted it.
Isabel had started to cry and then ran out of the flat. But it wasn't Isabel on the other end. It was Freddy. Charlie sat up in the tub and let the water run off his arm and hands before he put the phone to his ear and said, "Talk." "You wanted to know who was driving the stolen Audi that's been parked outside your apartment recently," Freddy said. His voice sounded miles away. "Well, the driver's sitting on a chair in front of me right now. He's a bit out of it as Hanselman gave him a bump on the head. We can carry on having fun if you like, but I thought maybe you'd have some questions you'd like to ask yourself." Charlie stood up. The bathroom mirror clouded over, but he could still see the outline of his well-rounded paunch. He got out of the bath and opened the door out into the hall. "Pick me up in 10 minutes. Hanselman can keep an eye on him in the meantime." "Okay, boss." As usual, Freddy sped through the streets, and it didn't take long before they stopped outside a half-finished building to which Charlie had managed to get the keys. The previous owner had had plans for a shopping center, but then went bankrupt before the project was complete. Charlie didn't know what he wanted to do with the site yet. It was far too small for his leisure complex, so while he bided his time for the right idea to come along, the place was perfect whenever they needed to talk privately to someone, one-on-one. The closest neighbors were well out of earshot. Charlie and Freddy walked down the spiral driveway that should have led to the shopping center's underground car park. The road was not surfaced, so they kicked up a dust cloud. There were a few lit bulbs down there, and, ahead of them, they saw a young man sitting on a chair with his hands tied behind his back. And behind him, a large, fair man with a goatee beard and huge tattoos on his arms. Hanselman was wearing a black, short-sleeved linen shirt and black linen trousers. Clothes that would hide a splash of blood or two.
"Mr. High, I swear..."
"Shh," Charlie said, and walked slowly towards the young man, who couldn't be more than 18 or 19. His skin was brown, childishly smooth, and he was sweating. A thread of blood was trickling down from one nostril, and there was a large red patch in the middle of his forehead. Quite literally, as Freddy had said.
"What's your name?"
Charlie asked.
"Eduardo."
The fear in his voice made him sound feeble.
"What else, Eduardo?"
He tried to straighten up.
"Eduardo de Jesus Silva."
"Where are you from? Nazareth?"
Charlie asked. Freddy and Hanselman laughed, even though Charlie had used the same joke before.
"I'm from Nepal,"
the boy said, in broken English.
"How old are you, Eduardo?"
19.
"And do you want to be 20?
He nodded quickly. Situations like this were always easier with young people, Charlie thought. A few simple threats were often enough for them to find out all they needed to know.
"So tell me, who do you work for? Is it someone in Norway?"
Eduardo shook his head.
"I don't work for anyone."
Freddy took a step closer, balled a fist, and punched it against his other palm. Eduardo de Jesus Silva paid attention.
"Please, Mr. High, I don't know what you..."
"You clearly know who I am."
Eduardo nodded.
"Everyone knows who you are."
"Who do you work for?"
"No one. I..."
"Why are you following me?"
"I..."
He looked away at Freddy and then turned to Hanselman, who put his great hands on the back of the chair and leaned forwards.
"I'm not following you,"
he stuttered.
"What are you doing then?"
"I..."
He closed his eyes. A pearl of sweat ran down one of his cheeks. A few long seconds later he said,
"I was dreaming."
Charlie stood there and studied him. His eyes widened, and the furrows in his brow deepened.
"My family's never had anything. My mom and sister clean other people's houses, rich people. Some of them live where you do. That's how I heard about you. My dad, he doesn't even have a job. All he does is...
Eduardo de Jesus Silva looked away for a moment.
And you,
he continued,
you've got it all. You live on the top. You've always got the best women. You never pay for your drinks.
He took a deep breath.
You've got it all,
he repeated.
So when I say I was dreaming that I was actually... Well, that I was you. That I had everything you have.
Charlie stared at him. Nobody should dream about having his life, he thought.
Why did you drive off then outside Senzuela the other night, he asked, when Freddy came over to talk to you?
Eduardo looked up at Freddy.
Look at him,
he said.
He's a mountain, and everyone knows that he's dangerous.
Freddy gave a crooked smile.
So what you're saying is, you were scared.
He lowered his head slightly, then nodded.
He had his hand in his inner pocket, Eduardo said. Everybody knows he carries a gun.
Charlie nodded slowly. He felt an enormous relief. He had nothing to fear, except that Henning Jewell was still alive.
So, what am I going to do with you? I don't need scaredy cats.
Please, Mr. High, just give me a chance. I know I can help you,
he pleaded.
How?
I know the town,
was his quick and eager answer.
I know people. I can do anything you ask me.
Charlie looked at his slight body, his thin face. The wind could probably blow him over. A slap would break him.
The car you're driving, Charlie said. How did you steal it?
Eduardo de Jesus Silva took another deep breath.
A friend of mine knew where the owner used to park it. I broke into his house and stole the keys.
Without being caught?
I wouldn't be sitting here otherwise.
Eduardo attempted a smile, but gave up as soon as he saw it had no effect. The first glimpse of cockiness, Charlie thought. He'd stolen a car exactly the same way in Norway when he was 17. He'd also dreamed of another life, a better life.
I don't employ criminals, he said,
then turned around and started to walk away.
Please, Mr. High!
But Charlie just carried on walking. Freddy followed.
What do you want me to do with him, boss? He asked when he caught up with him. Shall we...
Charlie lifted a hand as a sign that Freddy should stop talking. When they were out of earshot from the others, Charlie stopped and turned around.
See if you can find something for him to do, he said. Anything. Let's see what he's made of.
Freddy stared at him.
Are you sure, boss?
Charlie thought about it.
No, he said. But do it, all the same.
Chapter 35. When Henning woke up, he lay there blinking for a while, until the ceiling came into focus, and he remembered where he was. He had no idea why this particular thought struck him now, so soon after he'd woken, but he realized that it was a while since he'd been to see his mum. Henning had stayed away after she'd more or less accused him of killing his own father. He'd contacted social services to make sure she got what she needed in terms of food, cigarettes, and alcohol. But because she'd refused to say any more about her accusation, had given him no reason for saying what she'd said, he hadn't been able to bring himself to see her again. Now he found himself wondering if she knew he'd been shot, if she'd heard it on the news, or if someone had contacted her. If she cared. Slowly he levered himself up and put his feet on the floor, hobbled over to the table where the painkillers were, and took two. The wooden panelling on the walls in front of him seemed to move. He caught sight of his reflection in the window. His face was drained of any colour. He had big circles under his eyes.
It looked like he'd aged 15 years in the course of the past 2 weeks.
"Keep going. Just a little bit longer," he said to his reflection.
Henning thought about 6 Tiermis 7. Tiermis was one of the several names for the Sami god of thunder, who, according to mythology, ruled over life and death, a god who could call on thunder, kill trolls, who could wreak revenge. Then he thought about who might know that he'd been called in for questioning at the main station at 4 o'clock, and who might have told Durim Redzepi and his driver. It seemed they'd been waiting for him. One of the last things 6 Tiermis 7 had written the evening before was that he, or she, would try to log on around the same time this evening. Henning looked at the clock on the TV screen, which was still on. About 30 minutes to wait. He swallowed another tablet, went over to the wardrobe and looked inside, found a dark brown fleece and pulled it onto his good arm, then draped it over his shoulder and the sling, and staggered into the TV room. He felt like he was drunk. The house was silent.
Bjarne?
Henning stumbled a bit, trying to keep his balance while he waited for an answer. It didn't come. He took a couple of steps towards the stairs. Still, no answer. Henning concentrated hard, but could still only hear the faint humming of the fridge. The wood in the walls creaked, a sound that made Henning jump. He was used to similar noises from home, but the sound of timber moving always made him wonder, for a moment, if he was not alone. He went down to the kitchen. There was a handwritten note on the table.
"Had to go to work. Didn't want to wake you. Help yourself to what's in the fridge. Don't worry. You're safe. B.B.
Henning looked out of the window. All he could see was a hedge. The neighboring house with a light in one of the windows. Stars in a dark sky. He checked to see if he had any money. Found 2 200-kroner notes in his trouser pocket and put them on the island in the middle of the kitchen. Where was his phone? He couldn't remember if Bjarne had taken it with him. So instead, Henning used the house phone in the hall to call for a taxi. He asked them to send a car to Tennisvejen as soon as possible. Henning went back into the kitchen and gulped down a couple of glasses of water. He had to hold onto the counter in order not to fall over. He stood like this for 6 or 7 minutes. Then he ventured outside. The cold air made him realize how hot he was. He stumbled down to the garage. A taxi was parked outside the tennis hall. With great difficulty, Henning walked towards it and somehow managed to get into the back seat.
"Could you look up the address for Anne-Marie Sarah for me, please?" Henning asked as the car pulled out.
The driver was middle-aged and Asian-looking, and he asked Henning to spell the name for him. As he did this, they passed a car with 2 people sitting in it. It happened so fast that Henning didn't see the faces, but he noticed that the engine was switched off.
"Ivan Bjørndalsgate, is that right?" the driver asked.
"Don't know," Henning said, and tried to turn round. "But if there are no other addresses under the same name, that's where we're going."
The driver typed the address into the GPS. The car behind then turned on its lights and pulled out.
"And if you could put your foot on it, that would be great," Henning said.
The driver looked at Henning in the rear-view mirror and grinned. Henning held tight and for a moment considered whether he should get the driver to call Bjarne. He turned around and saw that the car was behind them. Was it Redzepi and his pal?
"I'll pay extra if you can go a bit faster." The distance between the two cars increased. When they jumped a light, the car behind, a Lexus, had to stop, and then suddenly there were three cars between them. They turned a corner and carried on at full speed, then turned into a bigger road, the driver still pushing the car over the speed limit. Henning felt certain that they'd managed to shake off the Lexus. He no longer felt the need to contact Bjarni. 10 minutes later, they stopped in Ivan Bjorndal's gate, to the east of the Aker River. Henning gave the driver a generous tip and got out. No other cars were moving on the street. He walked as fast as he could, but there was a slight delay between thought and movement, which made him unsteady. The brick buildings on either side of the road seemed to loom larger in the dark. Henning noticed that there were still plastic chairs and tables on the terraces. He saw lights in the windows. The local greengrocer was open. A man came out carrying a blue plastic bag. Opposite, there was a restaurant with big windows. It looked warm and inviting, but there weren't many customers inside. Henning stopped to draw breath. He blinked a few times, then walked on to number 17, where he looked for Anne-Marie Sarah's bell. He pressed the button and waited. Didn't get an answer. She might still be at work, he thought. So he crossed the street and went into a poorly lit park area, where he stood under a tree and waited. He couldn't do the fleece jacket up all the way, so it didn't offer much warmth, and his thin trainers did little to protect his feet from the cold ground. Henning was freezing by the time Anne-Marie Sarah finally appeared. He recognized her from Ivor's flat. She was small, with untidy hair and a quick step, as though she was always busy. Henning moved out from the shadow and said, "Hi, Anne-Marie." She stopped and looked up at him, with alarm in her eyes. "Or should I perhaps call you by your internet name, 6TM7? Sarah tilted her head and squinted, as though she wondered whether she'd heard right or not. "The Sami are generally proud of their roots," Henning said, "and you look like a woman who could have been born around 1967. She continued to look him square in the eye for a few seconds. Then she glanced around and took a step closer. "Did I not make it explicitly clear that we should never meet?" "Yes. And that suited me very well, until now."
"What does that mean?"
"You knew that I was going to Turnsburg today," Henning said. "And as you seem to have access to all kinds of information at headquarters, it would be easy enough for you to find out that I was coming in for questioning at 4 o'clock. Anne-Marie nodded pensively, and he saw the corners of her mouth twitching.
"So you think I told someone, who then came and shot you?"
Henning shrugged, with his good shoulder. She shook her head and pulled some keys out of her bag. She found the one she wanted, then walked towards the entrance. Suddenly she spun round.
"Henning, tell me, how long have we worked together?"
And before he could answer,
"How many cases have we drawn attention to? How many scoops have I given you?"
"Loads," Henning said.
"And yet you're standing here saying,"
she tried to find the right words,
"that I am involved in trying to have someone killed."
She pointed her thumb to her own chest.
"And you, of all people."
Henning didn't answer, just registered that he was feeling dizzy again. He had to squint in order to focus on her, and he saw a woman who looked like she wanted to punch him. Her eyes were glistening, and her cheeks were flushed.
"If that's what you truly believe, Henning, then you can go straight to hell."
Anne-Marie Sarah disappeared out of focus again.
"Then prove it,"
Henning said, and struggled to see better.
"I don't need to prove anything."
As she walked to the door, put her key in the lock, she shook her head and swore at him under her breath.
Henning followed behind, and forgetting the state he was in, tried to go too fast. Everything around him started to spin, and when he stopped abruptly, it was hard to keep his balance. As he fell to the ground, he saw the outline of a car a little further away, a car he recognized that he had seen not long ago. He didn't have time to notice anything else before something warm pressed down over his eyes, and everything went quiet. Chapter 36 Nora sat in the kitchen and tried to eat something. Not for her own sake. Food was the last thing she wanted, but for the baby. The banana tasted like cardboard, the yogurt like bad strawberries, but she managed to drink a glass of milk. Calcium and vitamin D were important. She also managed to swallow a couple of seal oil capsules with some water. It was evening, and the flat felt even quieter and darker than usual. She suddenly realized that she missed her mother. They'd agreed that she would come tomorrow, as it might be late by the time Nora got back from the hospital, and talking to the police, Agnes would have fussed about and stirred up a bit of life, if nothing else. Filled the walls with sounds. Nora decided to light some candles, so she went into the living room where she thought she'd left the matches. But the box wasn't on the table. She went back into the kitchen again and spotted the matchbox. On the counter. She was sure she hadn't left it there. Nora got the acute feeling that someone else was in the flat at that very minute. She listened. No movement. No sound. Nothing to indicate that another person was there. But the more she thought about it, the more certain she was. Someone had been in her flat while she'd been out most of the day. And now that the thought had taken root, she noticed a few other things that weren't as they should be. One of the magnets on the fridge had been moved. She hadn't hung the ultrasound photo there, had she? It was normally beside the sushi menu, not under the fridge brand name. The newspapers weren't hanging over the edge of the counter, as they had been this morning. Or was she imagining it? They could have been looking for something, she thought, something they thought Ivor had left here. But what could it be? Nora went back to the living room, stopped and listened again. Nothing. No strange sounds. But still she went out into the hall and inspected the lock on the front door. There was nothing wrong with it. But the umbrella. It had been knocked over and was lying on the floor. When had she done that? She blinked a couple of times. You're going mad, she said to herself. Go back into the living room, sit down, breathe, and go through it all again. Nora obeyed her own instruction and sat down on the sofa, concentrated on her breathing. She remembered her mother had taken down the ultrasound picture, looked at it, and then hung it back in a different place. She was pretty sure of that. And she could well have put the matches somewhere else without thinking about it. There was no need to panic. And, in any case, there were people down at street level keeping an eye on whoever went in and out of the building, and they would have noticed if anyone had broken into her flat. But had they been there when she was out? She looked at her watch. It was 12:15. That didn't stop her from dialing Bjarne Brogeland's number and asking.
No, they weren't there, he said in a weary voice. They're working shifts, and you were with me after all, so...
She heard a sharp intake of breath.
Why do you ask?
Well... She thought about it. It was highly unlikely that the people who had killed Ivor and shot Henning would risk breaking into her flat when all manner of people from the press and police were looking for them. And in any case, she knew nothing. She wasn't dangerous to them.
Is everything all right?
Bjarne Brogeland asked, with more force in his voice.
Yes, I think so.
Think so? Why do you say that?
Bjarne sounded suddenly more alert and slightly anxious.
Well, it's just... I got the feeling that someone has been in my flat, but I'm sure it's nonsense.
Do you want me to come over and check, or should I send one of the officers up?
No, no, she said. I'm sure it'll be fine. I'm probably just a little frightened or paranoid. I don't know. I'll be fine. Sorry for calling you so late.
Bjarne hesitated before saying,
That's okay. I'm still at work.
Oh, right. Is there any progress?
We're working on several leads, he said.
Vague, Nora thought. But then that's the sort of thing the police said when they had no hard facts.
Okay, she said eventually. Good night.
Good night. Try to get some sleep.
I will.
They both hung up, and Nora took a deep breath, then leaned back on the sofa, put her hands on her stomach. She hated to admit it, but the last 10 minutes had really frightened her. When Bjarne had come to the flat earlier in the day, he'd mentioned a carpenter called Rasmus Bjelland. Nora had planned to find out more about him, but should she really start digging around in something that had already got her partner killed? Weren't there more important things to think about in the time ahead? Henning was right, she thought, as she stroked her belly. She had to stay away from it all. It was too dangerous for them both.
Chapter 37 Roger Bleistad drove back and forth, around and around, couldn't bring himself to park the car and get out. Instead, he stopped at a spot where he had a good view of the cemetery and could see the maybe 30 people, including the minister, who were gathered around a large mound of earth. Bleistad let out a sob. He would have given anything to be standing there himself, singing, even though he never usually sang. To have shaken the minister's hand and been given an overdose of the words that always sounded so strange and impersonal. He could never bring himself to say them to other people who'd lost someone. He wondered who they all were and how they knew her, if they were neighbors or colleagues. Or maybe someone she'd gone to school with. No doubt people he'd never met before. It was a strange thought that other people he knew nothing about had also in some way been connected to the most important person in his life. He drove around the block again. When he got back, the small crowd was moving away from the grave. The minister had finished. She was in the ground. Bleistad sobbed again. He let the engine run as he watched them leaving the cemetery. He recognized Uncle Lars and some other family members, but no one else. Some people got into their cars, others stood around talking. One of them laughed.